It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out why smoking is still a big problem for people with lower income and education levels, while overall smoking levels are going down. First, it's time for a weekly look at the latest news in national politics. And one of the biggest stories of the week was in Georgia's 6th Congressional District, where a special election was held for a House seat. If you have any thoughts on that special election and its turnout, call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Yoni Applebaum joins us now. He's a senior editor for politics at The Atlantic. Yoni, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, it's nice to be with you again.
Well, this is just one seat, this Georgia 6th District seat. Why did it become such a big deal?
Well, everybody is looking for indications of where the country's headed. I think the election in November surprised both supporters and opponents of President Trump. And Democrats hoped to pick up a seat here and to send a clear message that voters were rejecting the Republican agenda in Congress and in the White House. And instead, a solidly Republican district rallied to elect a Republican.
We've seen some other special elections that were real long shots for Democrats, and Democrats came out and said, no, we didn't win, but look at how close it was. This was a good sign of things to come. It doesn't seem like they're saying that as much in this particular election.
Well, it's an interesting expectations game here. This was the most expensive race for Congress ever, and I think Democrats really got their hopes up after Ossoff performed well in the preliminary election. On the other hand, his performance last night was broadly consistent. Most of the special elections we've seen have ranged from 6 to 12% Democratic overperformance relative to the baseline. He was in that range. He ran, by most accounts, a fairly good race. He had an army of thousands of energized volunteers. And so you can look at this race and say Democrats are well positioned for 2018, or you can look at it and say, well, this is the fourth special election in rapid succession where Democrats have hoped to flip a district and fallen short.
What do we know about this district, and what is it about this district that made it seem like it was a possibility for Democrats to turn what had been a traditionally Republican stronghold into maybe a Democratic win?
One thing we saw in November was that white college-educated women who have long been a reliable Republican constituency, voting for a string of Republican presidential candidates by a decent margin, moved away from Donald Trump and from the Republican Party. And in general, affluent educated professionals were quite skeptical of Donald Trump. This, of all the congressional districts out there, this is the most heavily college-educated district that a Democrat does not currently represent. So to the extent that we are witnessing a national realignment, this is one place you'd expect that to come through. And I think the results were disappointing to Democrats because these were voters that hoped to persuade that Donald Trump was too crass, too unreliable, not fit or suitable for office, that the Republican agenda was out of line with their values. And instead, the results last night indicated that reliably Republican voters are willing to overlook what they've told pollsters are Trump's sins, but still tend to feel that their Republicans pose less of a threat to their values and way of life than sending a Democrat to put the Democrats back in the majority.
Republicans had been hitting the point that the Democratic candidate didn't actually live in the district, couldn't vote there, and some Democrats and the recriminations now are pointing that out. Did this end up coming down to more local issues like that instead of the nationalized issues?
Look, I mean, Tip O'Neill's famous dictum that all politics is local applies. Certainly, if the Democrats had to do it over, that they might well have chosen a candidate who was had more of a track record of holding public office. At the time that Ossoff jumped into this race, the landscape looked very different, and those sorts of candidates were less interested. But there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking after a race like this, and for the most part, I think people think he ran actually a fairly decent race. You might have been able to pick up the seat if you were a Democrat with a different candidate, but this was about local issues and about the candidates, to be sure. But by the time you're pouring tens of millions of dollars into a district, it really did become, to some substantial extent, a referendum on the Trump presidency. And Trump won that referendum.
Talking to Yoni Applebaum from The Atlantic, looking at some of the top national news stories of the week. Let's go a little closer to Washington, D.C. now. The Affordable Care Act repeal. Senate Republicans pushing toward a health care vote. They're saying by late next week is the expectation that, yeah, they'll in fact have a bill and a vote on their timeline?
Well, they say they'll show us the bill tomorrow, and then they'll vote on it by next Thursday. I think the expectation is that we're going to see a bill. What's in it is not entirely clear as yet, perhaps even to the people who are drafting it, and whether or not they actually have the votes necessary to pass it remains unclear. One thing I'd caution, though, is don't use the word repeal. The man who coined the phrase repeal and replace, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has stopped saying that he's going to repeal Obamacare. Instead, he's talking about changing it, altering it. And fundamentally, both the House bill and perhaps, based on what we're hearing, to an even greater extent, the Senate bill, amount to stripping out crucial features of Obamacare in ways that will have broad-ranging impacts on the lives of ordinary Americans. But they do not amount to repealing the fundamental framework of Obamacare. That seems to be something that both the House and the Senate have, at least for now, abandoned.
There's been, as you mentioned, a lot of concern over the process here. On Monday, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer questioned Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell about the process and the timing of the Republican Senate health care bill. Here's a listen.
Will we have time, more than 10 hours, since this is a complicated bill, to review the bill? Will it be available to us and the public more than 10 hours before we have to vote for it? Since our leader has said, our Republican leader, that there'll be plenty of time for a process where people can make amendments, you need time to prepare those amendments.
I think we'll have ample opportunity to read and amend the bill.
Will it be more than 10 hours?
We'll have ample opportunity to read and amend the bill.
I rest my case.
So what are we looking at between now and next Thursday as far as a timeline from what we know?
Well, I think that what we know is what McConnell has told us thus far, and the senator has been notably circumspect. We'll get, at the very least, an outline of the bill tomorrow. We may get the full legislative language. I think that's the likeliest thing to emerge. There will then be a frenzied few days in which people are trying to digest it, and then it'll move to a vote. One thing to bear in mind here is that two things are simultaneously true. The Senate and Congress in general have been sliding in this direction for a couple of decades now, increasingly trying to hack the legislative system in ways that subvert the ordinary process in order to get things done. That's true, and it's also true that it's never been done quite like this, or at least not in a century or more. So the Democratic complaints about the secrecy here are well-founded, but also build on a long-term trend within the Senate where the legislative process is now so dysfunctional and opposition so entrenched to any substantive changes that both Republicans and Democrats in recent years have resorted to extraordinary procedures in order to try to get legislation through the chamber.
And part of that procedure in this case is doing this in a way that requires just 51 votes instead of a 60-vote filibuster-proof majority. The Republicans need pretty much all the Republicans, or just about all the Republicans, to vote in favor of this to get this through. Does it look like it's likely that there will be defectors on the Republican side?
Well, McConnell's got two hall passes to hand out here. He can go down from his 52 members. He can let two of them vote against. There's a couple senators from more liberal states who seem inclined to claim them. That may be Susan Collins in Maine and Lisa Murkowski in Alaska. Alaska's sort of idiosyncratic on health care. There are also conservative opponents of this bill. And so what we're going to see over the next week is an elaborate dance as people lodging principal conservative objections to this legislation, often feeling that it doesn't go far enough, will try to move the bill in their direction, and McConnell will try to accommodate them without losing some of his more liberal members in the process. That's going to be a really difficult and delicate balancing act for the Republican majority in the Senate, and it's not entirely clear whether they can pull it off.
Yoni Applebaum is with us, senior editor for politics at The Atlantic, looking at some of the top political stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Democrats have a shot at a comeback in 2018, especially in congressional elections? Or will they see more losses like yesterday's special election in Georgia? What do you think of Republican plans to change the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare? Do you think they'll be able to come to an agreement? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. I'm picking up the conversation now with Yoni Applebaum, senior editor for politics at The Atlantic, looking at the big stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Call in about the Senate health care plan, special election in Georgia, and the future of congressional elections. And have you been following the White House's daily press briefings when they happen? What do you think of the job Sean Spicer has done? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller now. Mary is with us in Chippewa Falls. Mary, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Mary?
Well, I just wanted to make the comment about the Georgia election. I'm a Democrat, so I'm coming from the point of view of someone who would like a Democrat to be elected an additional seat to the House of Representatives. But I'm wondering where this framework came from, that this particular election was somehow this huge milestone or marker or humiliated defeat of the Democrats. It was always going to be a close race. There was no real reason to think that the Democrats were going to win, even though they poured an enormous amount of money into the race. And I just think that, you know, as an outsider, I understand when you're in a race, you're in Georgia, you're a Democrat, I understand getting, you know, that energy going. That goes with any type of political race. But I don't understand where this external in the media, everybody is like seeing this as a litmus test, and that somehow the Democrats have experienced this humiliating defeat. I think it's really dangerous to put it in those terms.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. I want to get Yoni in on this. And Yoni, this was coming from the media, but also from the Republicans and from the Democrats around the country.
Yeah, I'd actually say it's an interpretation that I've heard more often from Democratic operatives than from reporters. This is, you know, the Ossoff's performance, you would guess, just a generic Democrat in that district in a generic year would have polled at about 42%. He came in at about 48%. So although he lost, his performance last night suggests a very favorable national landscape for Democrats, and that's something that they can really take heart in. But many Democrats are tremendously frustrated by the Trump administration, by the effort to substantially trim Obamacare, and by the Republican agenda in Congress. Republicans have appointed their justice now to the Supreme Court after blocking Obama's pick. They control the White House and they control Congress. And very few Democrats are inclined to wait until 2018 to fight back. And so even races which would be very difficult for Democrats to win are getting freighted within the party with tremendous importance because they're looking for those hopeful signs. They're looking to send a message to vulnerable Republicans in Congress about the agenda that they're pushing, and they're trying to suggest that it's unpopular with voters. And we overperformed by 6 points, but lost is a more difficult message to send to Republicans who they're trying to warn than, look, this should have been a safe Republican seat and the Democrat picked it up.
Mary, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Julie on the line in Oshkosh. Julie, hi.
Hello. I was calling because I have heard nothing about how the changes to the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid would affect the core population of Medicaid, the people on SSI, elderly, you know, very low-income children. I have a son who is on SSI with an income of $800 a month. He will not have money for a health savings account or, you know, there's no extra funds there to pay a higher premium They talk about ending substance abuse and mental health counseling. Well, some people are on disability for mental health reasons.
Julie, thanks for the call. And Yoni, we don't know all the details of what's coming out of the Senate. It sounds like Julie's asking about people who might have been covered under Medicaid even before the Affordable Care Act came into effect. Do we know what the Senate plan is considering with that anyway?
You know, there have been conflicting reports. There are reports today, which I haven't personally been able to confirm, that it would apply to existing enrollees, which is not the case in the House bill. I don't want to feed the rumor mill here. I think one reason that there's so much frustration that this bill is not already public, that it has not gone through the ordinary process of committee hearings, is that for millions and millions of Americans, this is intensely personal. This is about their loved ones. It's about their families. And whether they support or oppose these changes, they're going to be impacted by them. They want a chance to let their members of Congress know about the impact of the legislation they'll be voting on. And they feel cheated out of the chance to do that because the bill has not been publicly debated before being rushed toward passage. And I think that your caller expresses that well, that the stakes here could not be higher. And whether you think these ideas are good reforms and much needed, or whether you think that they're terrible ideas, you really don't have a chance right now to call up your senator and let them know how you feel about them, because neither you or probably your senator knows what's in the bill.
Julie, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're looking at the top stories in national politics now with Yoni Applebaum from The Atlantic. Let's turn to a national story that's also a Wisconsin story. House Speaker Paul Ryan has a new challenger, Randy Bryce, an iron worker from Wisconsin, released an ad that's making the rounds now, critical of Paul Ryan's health care plans. Here's a listen.
I could do so much more, and I will do so much more, taking my voice, taking our voice, and what we need to Washington, D.C. I decided to run for office because not everybody's seated at the table, and it's time to make a bigger table. I'm the best person to represent this district because I'm a working person.
So Paul Ryan has low approval ratings right now, but he seems to keep handily winning elections, whether it's a primary challenge or a runoff. Is there any perception that Paul Ryan might be vulnerable next year, Yoni?
Well, I think next year is still a long ways away. This is a candidate who's twice run for office at the state legislative level and twice lost. Paul Ryan has a long track record of success and of delivering for his district, and that makes him a tough incumbent to knock off. But this is, these special elections are indicating that the national landscape has tilted away from Republicans. And even with gerrymandered legislative districts and the general urban concentration of Democrats, two features of the landscape that really do favor Republicans, seats that would ordinarily be quite safe, like Paul Ryan's, are suddenly more vulnerable. And there's some optimism among Democrats that a candidate like this can appeal to swing voters in that district. And part of the appeal here would be not just ordinary blue-collar working guy running against a Washington insider. It'd be the posture of the outsider. It's one thing we know from polling that really fueled Donald Trump's rise was the perception voters had that he wasn't part of the system. If Democrats, talking to party strategists, one of their key priorities for 2018 is recruiting candidates like this who can go to the electorate and say, hey, I'm not part of the system. Vote for me if you want change. And voters have a tremendous hunger for change.
Let's take a look at a story out of the White House now. Sean Spicer has been making fewer appearances at White House press briefings. Some people drawing attention to that. Fewer public press briefings from the president himself. Then a Sean Spicer no cameras, no recording conference, and then finally a normal one. What have we heard from the White House about their accessibility to the media?
Well, my colleague Rosie Gray asked Steve Bannon, the advisor to the president, about this, and he texted back, Sean got fatter. I don't think that's actually a plausible explanation for why they've curtailed press briefings, but I think it does reveal the general attitude of the White House toward the press corps. It's under no obligation to answer its questions, and that in general this is a White House which has doubled down hard on secrecy. that's something the last several presidents have done, but this administration has taken its secrecy and lack of transparency to really new extremes, and its hostility to the press. It openly flaunts and frankly tries to antagonize the press at times and to have public performative battles with the press because it's convinced that plays to its political advantage, that any time the media is a convenient whipping boy. It's one of the few institutions that may be less popular than the White House itself.
Are these White House briefings in the Trump administration or before useful? Do we actually get useful information out of them ever?
You know, the reason they've been conducted all these years is not out of some general sense of civic obligation. They're an opportunity for the president and his team to deliver their message to the press corps and through the press corps to the broader public. They've shifted since they've started to be broadcast as well as providing the gist for written stories, and they've shifted again more recently in the last decade or two as larger and larger audiences have started streaming them, as the cable networks have started carrying them live. And now they are, to some extent, performance vehicles. What they do, I think, is make it clear when the White House will and will not answer questions. That's one value they really do deliver to ordinary Americans. When there is something the White House would rather not address, and several reporters ask the press secretary about it, and he or she refuses to answer that question straightforwardly, that can be tremendously valuable. There's an accountability mechanism built into that. At the same time, we shouldn't be naive about this. The only reason they've happened this long is that administrations have been convinced that they generally work to their advantage. The Trump administration seems not similarly convinced that that's the case, and so it's trying its best to downplay them or to move them to venues and formats that will not provide the same degree of public interest.
Briefly on that metric of how often the White House spokesperson directly answers a question, how has Sean Spicer done on that measure?
I think even by the standards of a job not known for forthright communication, I mean, it's not as if previous press secretaries have been great answering questions. Sean Spicer has raised the non-answer to an art.
Yoni, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, always a pleasure.
That was Yoni Applebaum, senior editor for politics at The Atlantic. He joined us for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. First, a verdict was reached today in the trial of former Milwaukee police officer Dominique Hagan Brown. He was charged with first-degree reckless homicide in the death of Sylville Smith. Here's Judge Jeffrey Conan reading the verdict.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Dominique Hagan Brown, not guilty. Signed, the foreperson, dated this 21st day of June.
WPR reporter Ross Terrell was in the courtroom for the verdict. He joins us now. Ross, we heard the beginning of it. What was the reaction in the courtroom to that decision?
Yes, it was a very tense moment leading up to the decision, and when it happened, a member from the Hagan Brown supporters actually stood up and kind of pumped her fist in celebration, and you could see members of the Smith supporters, they were visibly angry, there were tears, there was frustration, they all got up and basically left the courtroom in unison. You could hear in the hallway some people yelling, crying, he won't get away with this, using profanity. It was a very tense moment. There was a lot of anger before the police ushered them down the hallway and out to the elevators to leave the courtroom.
Remind us of the incident that led to this trial.
Yes, it was a shooting that took place last August. Officer involved was a chase of Sylville Smith, and he was armed with a gun. He was shot twice. The first shot hit him in the arm as he went to get rid of the gun, and he then fell onto his back with his hands kind of to the side and his arms and legs up, and that is when Dominique Hagan Brown, the officer who was found not guilty, fired the second fatal shot into his chest, and that was kind of the focus from the state, was it was that second shot that was the reckless homicide.
And what was the argument from the prosecution about that second shot?
They said basically at that point there was no intent from Sylvia Smith to harm Hagan Brown. There was no weapon. He clearly got rid of it, and there was no delivery system. He had no way of harming Hagan Brown. And they even pointed that the other officer who was with Hagan Brown at the time, he never pulled out a weapon or had his hand on his gun, and that second shot was unnecessary.
And what do we hear from the defense of the officer?
The defense of the officer was saying all of this was happening in real time. You can't look at it in a frame-by-frame look. Hagan Brown had to process a moving scene, so he couldn't really step back and pause and say, okay, the weapon's gone, he has no way of harming me. It's a fast-moving situation. It's fast-paced.
Now, both the officer and Sylval Smith were African-American. Did issues of race come up during the course of the trial?
Throughout the trial, you didn't hear issues of race from the attorneys. That has been a common theme within the community. You heard it from some of his family members after the trial. There was even a moment after where a bystander was voicing his displeasure, and one of the family members had to remind him, we need to stay together in this. Respect the family. We need to all come together. But you did not hear anything about race from either of the attorneys.
And what else do we hear from the family of Sylval Smith after the ruling?
Just pain. His sister, Sherelle Smith, she spoke through tears. His dad, Patrick Smith, also spoke. They called for peace, among all things, but this verdict, they were obviously disappointed. Any time, you know, they mentioned, you took somebody away from us. That was a son, a brother. And his sister had a plea that typically I haven't heard before, and she said, don't give police a reason to harm you. Just give yourself up. Just surrender. Do whatever you have to do, but do whatever you can to not be in a position to allow police to take your life.
And did we hear anything from the police department yet since the ruling?
Yeah, we heard the member of the Milwaukee Police Association. He spoke, and he basically said he is thankful to a mindful jury in this decision. He commended Hagan Brown for putting himself in harm's way. And he said, you know, we didn't lose an officer. An officer is still here. It is a sad day anytime a citizen loses their life, but he was thankful to the jury for coming to the decision that they arrived at.
Is there a concern of unrest after this ruling, as there was after the initial incident in the Sherman Park neighborhood?
The concern is definitely there. I know a lot of people who I spoke with at that time said the riots after the initial shooting were kind of a powder keg. It's not typical of the community, but it was definitely on the minds of the families as they did call for peace. They did ask that this is peaceful, that we come together, the community comes together in this situation. And so they were definitely thinking about it. And I think in a situation like this, with a lot of anger, with the family still being in the community, you never know, but there were calls for peace.
Ross, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
That's Ross Terrell, WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. He joined us with information about the verdict and the trial of former Milwaukee police officer Dominique Hagan Brown. He was found not guilty of first-degree reckless homicide in the death of Sylval Smith. After years of campaigns, warning labels, taxes, and more, the number of adults who smoke in the United States, the percentage of adults, is at a record low. But smoking has dropped more drastically for people with money and higher education levels. Over about 50 years, smoking dropped 83% for people with a college degree, only 39% for people who have completed some level of high school. That class and educational divide is changing the game for smoking cessation in the United States. Bruce Christensen joins me now. He's a senior scientist at UW-Madison's Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Bruce, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Is this new, this massive gap based on income and education when it comes to smoking?
I think the size of the gap is new every year because it's growing. So that if you look at the mid-60s when we started tracking this, there was no gap. And then just very consistently over the years, the gap is getting bigger and bigger and bigger every year. So we're going in the wrong direction. We're not closing the gap.
What accounts for this big difference?
Well, that's an excellent question. And every good excellent question probably has lots of different answers. One of which we know the tobacco companies target certain populations, so that's a piece of this. But it's also a more general phenomena that, you know, the tobacco control effort has been incredibly successful, as evidenced by the overall drop down to 15% from a high of 42%. And that reflects a lot of public programming efforts. Raising taxes, protecting kids from secondhand smoke, clean air acts, restricting advertising, having free telephone quit lines, having medications that can help people quit. But the fact is, all those programs, by their nature, are always more effective on people who have resources, the haves, if you will, and less so on the have-nots, because the have-nots have less resources to bring to the table, so to speak. So there's all kinds of barriers that they have that are more prominent than the people who are better off.
Let's talk about medical access here for a moment. I saw part of the story, it looks like, is people who have access to a primary care physician, somebody they work with, are more likely to get smoking cessation help than, say, a lower-income person who might not have that regular doctor. Their only access is maybe in an emergency room. How important a part of the picture is that?
That's certainly an important piece, and you put it quite accurately. If you don't have health insurance, you often only have the wherewithal to get to emergency room urgent care when you have no choice. And that's not the best setting to have a provider deliver a tobacco intervention. They're preoccupied dealing with an urgent or emerging health crisis. And so it's best delivered by a primary care physician at a routine visit. But that's something that people with low incomes don't have access to. For example, just out today was an article that tracked the use of medications that can be attributable to the Medicaid expansion states. And they went up by 38%. So these would all be low-income now folks who, through the newer insurance programs, have access to medications that can help.
That's under the Affordable Care Act?
Yes.
Did we see smoking rates change much with that increased access?
Too early to tell. If you look at the rate of declining in smoking, it's been a pretty consistent slow lowering through the last 50 to 60 years. It did accelerate in the past 8 years, but there's been additional efforts in the communities, increased taxes, for example, that could explain some of that.
Now, as I understand it, one thing that seems not to work very well when it comes to smoking cessation is scolding, nagging, shunning type behavior of people who smoke. What have we learned about that?
I think that's true. And I think you can understand that when you realize that if you ask people if they want to quit, most will say, yeah, I'd like to quit, or I plan to quit someday, because most people have some at least general understanding that it's not good for health. And yet if you ask them, okay, well, then that's at a quit date, and all of a sudden that's not a very good idea, that sometime in the future is better. And so I think the negative punitive approach is not very productive. And actually re-stigmatizing it. And that's particularly relevant to this discussion because when you think about who's doing the smoking now, it's people out by the bus stops. It's low-educated, low-income workers. They already have a burden of stigma. And now to do it again, to say, well, you're one of those that haven't been able to quit, that's just an additional burden for them.
The burden of stigma and the burden of stress. People with in a lower income situation might have a precarious, obviously, financial position. That's stressful. They turn a lot of people who have smoked use it in times of stress. And as I understand it, quitting smoking is incredibly stressful itself. How do we deal with that stress cycle?
Yes, I think that's a good observation. The treatments overall work for across the entire population. So it really is a matter of freeing up the resources to really tailor things and target the people that are still remaining smoking. And then addressing, and part of that is addressing their stress level.
Bruce Christensen is with us, senior scientist at UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Looking at why smoking is still a big problem for people with lower incomes, lower education levels. Also, we'll get into this in rural areas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been or are you currently a smoker? Have you tried to quit? How has it gone? What was it like for you? If you have quit, what worked? And is this your story? Are you somebody at a lower income level and you're having trouble maybe accessing medication that could help you quit? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Bruce Christensen, senior scientist at UW-Madison's Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. We're looking at a class divide in adult smoking rates, rates overall going down in the United States, staying higher than I think anyone would like for people with lower incomes, lower education levels, often in rural areas. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing this in your community? If you are in a lower income community, do you see a lot of tobacco ads on a billboard at the local corner store? Do you feel like you have the community support, the medical resources you would need to quit if you're a smoker? If you have quit, tell us what worked for you. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Bruce, let's talk about that advertising part of the story now. People in the lower income groups are more likely to smoke, and they're the more likely people to see advertisements.
Yeah, it's the preference that we've had some really successful policies, but sometimes they have unintended consequences. So one good example of that is, you know, we by legislation have restricted where a tobacco company can advertise. They can't sponsor TV shows, for example, anymore. Well, that has only allowed them then to put the resources in other types of advertising, one of which is we call point of sale, so they can advertise in places that are selling tobacco products. That's well and good. But then you ask, okay, so where are those places you can buy tobacco? And it turns out that if you look at the concentration of people who are in programs that sell tobacco, they're much more dense in zip codes made up of a higher proportion of people with low income. And that's, again, not intentional, but, again, the urban poor areas have a lot of mom-and-pop stores on the corners, and many of those will sell tobacco products, which means if you're a young child walking to your neighborhood school, you'll be going by and seeing a lot more seductive ads for tobacco.
How are we doing on youth smoking rates?
Actually, they're coming down quite nicely. They hit a peak around 2000-2002, increased again in the middle of the 2005, but lately they've been coming down, which has been really encouraging.
Do we have data on whether we're seeing a similar divide by income level, I guess, of the family for kids that we do for the adults that we've been talking about?
Yes, I think it mirrors that, reflects that quite similar.
Now, you mentioned proximity to ads in inner cities. Part of the story here is low income rural areas, Native American communities sometimes seeing higher rates of smoking. What can we do to target resources to help in those areas?
Yeah, the barrier there is inherent to the rural areas would be access to health care that's convenient and easy to get to, which tends not to be the case. So we would need resources to deliver cessation programs in a convenient, kind of barrier-free manner, and that's always a challenge for rural health care.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Joseph is with us now in central Wisconsin. Joseph, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I wanted to talk to you about quitting. I quit 27 years ago when I became a Christian, and I started looking at my life. And it made me examine my health issues. And so I quit smoking, doing drugs, and drinking 27 years ago.
Congratulations. And you're still quit now?
Yes, sir.
And I understand you told our producer you now help other people quit.
Yes, sir. I've become a pastor. And as a pastor, I meet people and talk with them about their life issues. And sometimes they're interested in quitting smoking. And I also have helped people in recovery.
Joseph, thank you so much for sharing that. Congratulations on quitting and now on helping other people. How important is that kind of community support, Bruce, whether it's from a pastor in Joseph's case or other community members?
Absolutely key, which, again, is another barrier faced by low income because they're more likely surrounded by other smokers because the prevalence is much higher. So we know one of the three key ingredients to be successful quitting is having good interpersonal support from peers, family, et cetera, in the community. And that's often not as prevalent and available in low-income areas.
Joseph, thanks for that call. Go next to Dick in Sioux City, Iowa. Hi.
How you doing?
Good. What's your story?
Well, I started smoking out when I was 12. I quit when I was 29 years old. Now I'm 70. I never smoked again. I used hypnosis. We had a psychologist that came into town. He was a Hispanic fella. It cost me $50. It took about half an hour. He used waking hypnosis and told me I'd never smoke again.
Well, and it turns out he was right. Thanks a lot for that call. Bruce, we've heard from our callers there. Cold turkey and hypnosis, state-of-the-art science-wise nowadays. What are the proven methods, the things that seem to work best?
The way to increase the odds of any particular quit attempt would be three things. I already mentioned one of them, which is having as much support as you can marshal. The second is very basic, practical behavioral coaching or counseling about how to get through an urge to quit, how to distract yourself when you have an urge, just some very basic skills, because it does take some skill to quit. And the third is using one of the seven FDA-approved medications that will help take the edge off the urge to smoke.
And as I understand it, it can be people who try, quit for a bit, and then start again can feel really demoralized and have a hard time making that next effort. But that's really normal, right?
It is normal. Keep in mind that this nicotine addiction is a very difficult addiction to beat. Multiple tries are the norm, the most common. And you're right, demoralization is a problem because we know one of the best predictors of success is self-efficacy. That is the belief that I can do it this time. So what we would prefer people to do is when they have an experience that they've quit for some length of time and then they've lapsed, to take that as a success, an opportunity to learn, what did you encounter that was more than you had expected? Well, what could you do different next time? And then telling yourself that, okay, next time I know more, it'll be different this time.
And Bruce, let's get to what it's all about. As smoking rates have declined overall, how much of a difference has this made for our overall health?
Oh, just a tremendous difference. There's an amazing correlation between the graph that shows the decrease in smoking and the graph that shows the decrease in deaths from lung cancer, for example. There's about a 20-year delay. Shows up about 20 years later, but the lines are absolutely parallel, meaning you could just make a direct relationship between the fact that we have so relatively fewer smokers now and deaths from lung cancers is on the decrease. So it is still the number one preventable cause of death in our country.
That said, if this disparity between rich and poor continues in smoking, that's going to increase health disparities that are there for other reasons, right?
Yep. And we do believe that smoking rates in these populations is one of the big drivers of the overall health disparity.
And can you tell us, as we start to wrap up, what resources are there out there in Wisconsin for people looking to try to quit for the first time or the fifth time?
I would just draw quickly two things. One, like all states, we have a tobacco quit line that's free to every resident in Wisconsin. The number is 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They will provide free coaching and counseling, one of the two ingredients I talked about, as well as the support. And they also provide 2 weeks of free nicotine replacement product, the patch, the gum, or the lozenge. And that's not a full course, but that's enough to get somebody started. And the second resource is talking to a health professional, hopefully your primary care physician or nurse practitioner. They've all been well-trained to address tobacco as well.
Bruce, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Good luck to all your listeners who smoke.
That was Bruce Christensen, senior scientist at UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. He joined us to look at some recent data showing that smoking is still more common among low-income Americans, people with lower education levels, often people in rural areas. Still time for you to share your thoughts on that topic and maybe your own story as well. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us if you smoke, are you trying to quit? If you did quit successfully at some point in your life, or if you're on a third or fourth or fifth try, good luck to you, and tell us all about it on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're looking to own a piece of history with a Wisconsin connection and you have $4.5 million to spare, I've got a good deal for you. A house in Harlem where Harry Houdini lived for 20 years is up for sale. The legendary escape artist grew up in Appleton after his family immigrated from Hungary in 1878. He became a hit with his magic and escape act, and he bought this New York house in 1904, spent the rest of his life based there. He had it modified in some ways to meet his unique needs, including a really, really big bathtub so he could practice those underwater escape tricks. If you buy the house, as I understand it, the bathtub is no longer there. It's been converted for more normal bathtub uses. If you're not up for a move to New York and $4.5 million is a little steep, you can learn more about Houdini closer to home. Check out the Houdini exhibit in Appleton at the History Museum at the Castle. And I would worry, you know, if I bought the Houdini house with, you know, that $4.5 million I've just got in my desk here, I'd spend all my time thinking, oh, he's got to have some secret escape here or some trick. Or I've heard sometimes, you know, if you buy an old box from Houdini, you have to watch out for the crashing blade or something like that, because he collected all sorts of weird magic and escape stuff. So if you put in a bid for the house, let us know how it goes. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.